And first up, we're going to have Space Show News. Yay, ring out the bells, because there, as a record has just been broken, there are now 17 people in space orbiting their planet. The first time ever in human history that there have been 17 people in orbit around our planet. They include seven of the residents, normal residents of the International Space Station. There are Russians, American citizens, and one from the United Arab Emirates. And there are four guests aboard the space station as well. That's two United States citizens and two Saudis. Yes, from Saudi Arabia, a man and a woman. And that's the first time in history that there have been three people from Arabia in space. The first time ever that's happened. One from UAE and two from Saudi Arabia. The Axiom 2 crew, the four of them on the International Space Station, coming down soon. And that's a commercial mission. In addition to that, there are six Chinese people in space. Three aboard Tiangong. And I haven't checked recently, but yesterday they launched another three into space, and that brought the total from 14 in space up to that magic number 17. So 17 people in space for the first time in history. Now, what about those Chinese people? Well, here is the crew announcement made just a few days ago.
As evaluated and decided by the mission headquarters, Shenzhou 16 manned spaceship is targeted to launch at 9:31 May 30th, Beijing time. Crew members are astronauts Jin Haipeng, Zhu Yangzhu, and Gui Haichao, with Jin Haipeng as the mission commander. Astronaut Jin Haipeng has flown Shenzhou 7, 9, and 11 manned spaceflight missions. Zhu Yangzhu and Gui Haichao will this time have their first spaceflight.
Now, the first medical doctor to go into space was the Soviet Union's Boris Yegorov. In 1964, just 3 years after graduating with a medical degree, Boris was one of three cosmonauts aboard Voskhod 1. They made 16 orbits of the Earth in a time of just a smidge over 24 hours. Well, 50 years ago this week, the first United States medical doctor to orbit the Earth was aboard the Skylab space station. Joe Kerwin was one of a small group of scientist astronauts. In a talk last week to the Space Association of Australia, Joe described that group.
We started out with six, and one guy had to leave before we really got started. These are the first scientist astronauts. And we have an Air Force pilot, an engineer, a geologist, a researcher, and a physician. The other physician didn't make it all the way.
A high priority objective of the Skylab 2 mission were the biomedical experiments. One of Joe Kerwin's crewmates was Pete Conrad. Now, Pete had flown two Gemini missions in Earth orbit and commanded the Apollo 12, which was the second lunar landing mission for humans. Now, Joe, in his talk to the Space Association, spoke highly of Pete Conrad.
So here's the prime crew, you and your colleagues, Pete Conrad
We got along just great. Pete is a very outgoing guy. He's opinionated, but he's also willing to listen. He was very good to PJ and me. You just convinced him you were working hard, and he let you do what you wanted to do pretty much.
That's great.
And so Pete was great to have. But the other thing about Pete was that he would speak up at any level required to try and get something fixed. And in the mission, in the first week of the mission, you know, we had big solar panel locked down, and we were preparing the backup crew was preparing a scenario for us to do that. So we were very underpowered, and we had this absolutely mandatory spacewalk coming up on day 10 or 12. And we had difficulties working the ergometer to stay in shape. It was a bicycle ergometer, and one of the backup crews had designed a very elaborate shoulder harness to keep us firmly down on the seat. But that's not how you ride a bike. You don't ride a bike firmly down on the street. You get your behind up there and you push it, you know. And we discovered up there that that is true, and that we could not, wearing that harness, get up to our maximum energy levels, work levels, because the straps cut through the thighs, cut off the circulation to your legs, and they just quit along about 100%. So that was no good. And we were working on that. And the boys in mission control, and particularly the surgeons, you know, this was the big medical mission they'd all been waiting for. And they were nervous as heck about something going wrong. And Pete was working so hard trying to get up to speed that he was throwing an occasional premature contraction. No harm. It appeared, you know, infrequently and was not a sign of a heart problem. But they insisted that Pete, that nobody was going to ride that bicycle unless it was over a stateside pass where they could look at every heartbeat. And Pete couldn't go in the spacewalk. Well, Pete said, director, and Pete and Chris had a nice conversation. I was only asked to break in to assure Dr. Kraft that Pete and the rest of us were in excellent physical condition. And he said, call the doctors off. And the doctors agreed, compromised, that if Pete was able to do a run on the bicycle without a PVC, he could go on the spacewalk. And at the same time, we found out the solution to the harness. The solution to the harness was to carefully wrap it up and replace it in the locker from whence it came. Ride that bike by just letting your body go forward till your CG was over the wheels, and you could go as high as you wanted. And so he did one of those, and he didn't have a PVC, and we did the spacewalk, and it worked.
Several Apollo astronauts had been sick to the point of vomiting early in their missions. Naturally, Dr. Kerwin was keen to investigate this phenomenon.
Just on screen there, Joe, I think there's a shot there of you, that spinning chair that you were talking about.
Silly rotating chair. Yes, this is a 1G look, obviously. The way I'm bending over, you can just tell. And Pete's got his Minnie Mouse headgear on there to close his eyes. And he's got we all had molds made of our teeth so that you could then attach the mold to the that sidebar, and your head would be absolutely still for certain parts of the vestibular experiment. It had about four parts. And so we're doing that, but the bad part of the rotating chair was when you took that stuff off and you started nodding your head and rotating at a speed guaranteed to that for you to not like it, you know. And again, I'm getting ahead of myself, but the discovery on orbit was from the very first time, and we delayed doing this testing until about day 7 or day 8, depending on the crew member, to let you get totally over any DSMS that you might have had earlier in the flight. What is DSMS? Well, the doctors called it space adaptation syndrome, because they were too polite to say space motion sickness. But we crew members called it dreaded space motion sickness, or DSMS. I've got a shirt that says stamp out DSMS.
Fantastic.
So we didn't want to get close to that, and we found that in weightlessness, once you were adapted, you didn't get space motion sickness from rotating in the chair. And that was a glorious invention or find out.
Medical doctor and astronaut Joe Kerwin speaking last week via video link from his home to the Space Association of Australia about his experience 50 years ago aboard the Skylab space station. Half a century later, the medical aspects of human spaceflight is still a matter of investigation. Rowena Christensen has not had the privilege of flying in space, but nonetheless has an interest in the challenges of clinical medicine in space. In 2019, she was introduced to the Moon Village Association at a meeting in the Deakin Edge Theatre at Federation Square by Mark Gerblum, a trainee psychiatrist.
Dr. Rowena Christensen is another member of the Space Life Science Committee. She's a medical educator at the Melbourne Medical School. She also works as a pre-hospital emergency doctor and life support instructor. She's undertaken postgraduate training in emergency medicine, crit care, women and children's health, aviation medicine, space studies, and disaster health and emergency management. Rowena has interests in aerospace medicine, extreme environments, and wilderness medicine. She's the chair of the Australian Ski Patrol Association Medical Advisory Committee and sits on the Australian Resuscitation Council and the Board of Directors for the Mars Society Australia and the World Association for Disaster and Emergency Management. Rowena is currently undertaking research related to expeditionary medicine and resuscitation science. Her career trajectory prior to entering medicine was as a lawyer and businesswoman. Rowena is going to give us an introduction into how we actually provide medical care in space and some of the challenges we need to overcome in order to support human spaceflight to the moon.
Great. So I am basically going to give you a whistle-stop tour through some of the challenges that we face when we're trying to perform clinical medicine in a space environment. I'm going to talk quickly about the planning that we need to do, issues with communications and evacuation, telemedicine and robotic surgery, the equipment and pharmaceutical supplies that we might need, nutritional support, which you might not immediately think is something which is an obvious part of medicine, what type of doctor we want to take, and also just some of the special issues for surgery and anaesthesia in microgravity or low gravity environments. So human missions always require a great deal of planning, and we need to have the right people, the right equipment, and we also need to have levels of redundancy, because once we're out there, we're going to be pretty well unsupported and we're going to need to manage things on our own. We also need to take the right sort of people who are fit and healthy and not so likely to develop medical problems. If we're thinking about things like communication for telemedicine, there's not too much of a delay for the International Space Station or the Moon, but once we're getting out to Mars, there's potentially quite a long delay of between 8 and 24 minutes, depending on where Mars is in its orbit. And if we have someone who's very unwell, evacuation might be quite reasonable from the International Space Station, but even with Mars, we're looking at around 3 days, so we wouldn't want them to be too unstable if we're thinking about sending them back to Earth. And of course, it's just not possible to evacuate somebody quickly from Mars. Telemedicine will certainly play a part. It's very useful for getting advice and potentially instructions. For instance, if you have someone with swelling on the brain and you want to drill a burr hole into the side of their temple to relieve the pressure. That's something that's been done via telemedicine here on Earth already. But there will be some dependencies. You'll need the right equipment. You'll need to have a stable electrical supply. The communication delay will be a factor, and you'll also need good space weather, so no solar flares that are going to get in the way. And it's going to need to be more of a backup strategy than something that we're going to rely upon. This is a picture of a robotic surgery procedure. In the bottom left, you can see the surgeon staring into a screen, manipulating the instruments. And then we have the patient on the table with the robot actually doing the surgery. There are two models, one where the operator and the robot and the patient are all in the same room, and the other model where the patient is in one place and the person who's operating the controls is at a distance. And depending on the communications delay, that may be feasible for some types of surgery, but there would be the same dependencies as for telemedicine that I've just mentioned. NASA's also looking into the possibility of autonomous surgical robots, but if you've ever seen the movie Prometheus, I'm not so sure about whether that's a good idea. And also, in reality, it's maybe a bit more likely that somebody will be trained up on the spot via a video or additional instructions to be able to perform the procedure. We'll need to have laboratory tests. Blood tests are always going to be an important part of medicine, but they're going to need to be something we can take with us that's going to be stable. It's not going to deteriorate too quickly. And we're probably not going to be able to have established laboratory facilities with high level of specialised tests until colonisation is well established. We're also going to need some access to medical imagery, because being able to see inside the body is a very important part of what we do in terms of working out what's wrong with people. Ultrasound is already being used on the International Space Station, and it's probably the most portable of our imaging modalities. And there are also small handheld versions which are currently being used by cardiologists. If we're thinking about X-ray machines or CT scanners or MRI scanners, they're fantastic pieces of equipment, but they're very, very large and heavy. And so there may well be practical constraints in terms of taking them on a spacecraft and transporting them elsewhere. So that might be something that will need to come in the second wave of getting a colony established, for instance. We're going to need to take medicines with us to deal with common emergencies, and perhaps also supportive things like vitamins and minerals. Once again, there'll be logistical issues. We're going to be stuck with what we can take with us. We're going to want it to be stable in transit, so shelf life could be a problem. And there's also a question of the risk of degradation due to cosmic radiation. You might ask why nutritional support is something I've highlighted as important, and that's because we need our astronauts to be as healthy as possible, and that's been highlighted by NASA as one of the risks for human space exploration. In particular, we need to have a good, strong immune system and good wound healing capabilities, and there's quite a lot of research to show that our immune system works less well in extreme environments such as the space environment. Food security is always going to be an important issue, and there's certainly a lot of research into growing your own food, but at the moment this is mainly around plant-based food. And if you have a purely vegan or vegetarian diet, you're not going to get all your nutritional needs from that diet. And so supplementation may be required. And it's also important to have a good gut microbiome to support our immune system. So you need a good balance on both prebiotic and probiotic foods. So fermented foods for the probiotics and fiber-rich foods for the prebiotics. In terms of the type of doctor that we want to take, we need to think about whether we want to take generalists like emergency doctors or GPs or specialists or a mixture of both. And the elephant in the room relates to the fact that humans will be humans and the risk that somebody may fall pregnant, and then how do you manage a pregnancy and childbirth in a microgravity or low gravity environment? And gravity is also the elephant in the room for surgery and anaesthesia. I couldn't find any papers on surgery on the moon, so I'm just going to talk about a microgravity environment. But liquid containment is a real issue. If you have venous blood, it will tend to pool where it's oozing out, which will get in the way of everything, and arterial blood will spurt into all those lovely little globules that you've probably seen floating around in science fiction movies. And bacteria will always be hanging around in the air, and you'll risk both the wound getting contaminated or bacteria actually getting stuck in a cavity. Some possible solutions. NASA's looking at putting a fluid-filled dome on top of the patient and operating through that. And there's also research on using focused ultrasound to perform surgery. So both of those are quite interesting ideas. With anaesthetics, there are also problems as well, because if we use vaporous anaesthetics, they'll just hang around in the air and we might run the risk of anaesthetising everyone. And also the changes in physiology could have an impact. So the lessons from pre-hospital medicine are probably going to be useful, and perhaps more of an emphasis on just anaesthetising the part of the body that you're operating on, if that's a reasonable thing to do. So in conclusion, there are many challenges for clinical medicine. They're all interrelated. There'll be a lot of trial and error, but that's the way that we're going to learn. And success is going to come through teamwork, not just through the efforts of one person. Thank you.
Speaking at a meeting of the Moon Village Association at Federation Square here in Melbourne, that was Rowena Christensen, a medical educator at the Melbourne Medical School. This has been The Space Show.